This is entitled Economics of the Ghetto, Why It's More Expensive to Live When You're Poor. I'm Barry Shelley. I'm the program associate at Holden. And I guess I should tell you a little bit about my background before I came to Holden and why I have a right to talk on any of this stuff. I moved to the Northwest just about a little over a year ago from Boston, and lived in the inner city Boston for about 8-9 years, where I was involved in working out of a church, but I was doing primarily youth work and community organizing around housing issues. Was the major focus of my work for several years. I was on the board of directors for a community development corporation that has just about finished now building about a $35 million mixed income housing project, which was about a 20-year struggle with the city over land rights and uses. But it's pretty much of a, I could talk about that specifically, but it was quite a victory, I think. I feel like people who had been involved in that for about 20 years finally actually can see this project, which is now almost complete. But I did live in that. It was a neighborhood that is about 40% white, about 30%, 35% black, and about 25% Hispanic. There are a few percentages even of Native Americans, and Chinatown bordered the neighborhood, and Chinatown was expanding. So it's very mixed racially and also income-wise, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. It for years had been a quite low-income neighborhood, and there were some of the more notorious housing projects in the neighborhood, which is close to where I used to work. But at the same time, it was becoming one of the fashionable neighborhoods to live in the last, say, 10 or 15 years. And the whole clash of that is something that I want to talk about more. So what I have planned today really comes out directly out of that experience. And I have studied economics, and I do some sessions here on third world economics and debt crisis and that sort of thing. So I have some background in that. One of my degrees is in public policy, but I'm not going to really today go a lot into specific economic issues in a technical sense, and really want to spend more of the time just reflecting on some specific areas in which, through my own work and experience, I have seen what I would call, sometimes I've called this kind of session, legal discrimination. In other words, ways in which poor people and very often racial minorities are discriminated against in ways that are perfectly legal. There's nothing illegal about them. It's the way that simply the economics of the city and suburbs and neighborhood structures tend to make it harder for poorer people to live. So I sort of outlined, I guess I'm in the way here a little bit. A little bit of what I want to talk about. I want to just talk for a minute about the fact that poverty is rising in the United States, which is something that we don't usually want to hear, but it's true. And then just talk about the areas in which housing, food, community development, and transportation are four primary ways in which I just want to cite some specific ways in which poor people really do have to pay more for those things. It's more expensive in some ways for people to get their housing and their food if you're poor. And then to end by just talking a little bit about the suburban-urban tax structure. And it's something that we don't usually talk about, but it's another way in which it's really sometimes cheaper to live in the suburbs in a really nice neighborhood and home than it is to live in the city. So I hope that what I have to share will be simply something that I'm sure some of you are already aware of a lot of this, and please feel free to join in and add to whatever or disagree. And at the same time, I hope it will be something that will be some new information for some of you to think about. Please feel free to interrupt with a question if you have one. Those we go along, and I plan to have plenty of time to talk about this at the end. Okay, first of all, just poverty in the United States. I put up poverty rates over here in red. And you can see, 1959, 22% of Americans were under the poverty line. I should just say, a poverty line, the way it's figured by the government, is not even a really good indication of poverty as far as I'm concerned. The poverty line is an income calculation based basically just on one or two basic needs for, say, a family of four. And frankly, I think it's very hard for people to live on the amount that we calculate as being the amount necessary to live on. But still just taking those as the official rates. In other words, what I'm saying is really more, I think we should really count more than, say, 15% of people in 1984 as being really poor. But these are the official rates, so we'll use them. You can see that by 1966, there was a really major drop in poverty, and that's primarily due to the programs in the 1960s. Now, there's certainly some problems with those and whether or not how long-term they were. We can talk about that, but I do think the fact is that it did make an impact on poverty in the United States, the Great Society programs of Johnson eras and that sort of thing. By 1970, it had dropped further, and then what happens essentially between 1960 and 1970, there are major changes in poverty levels in the United States. Since then, things have really not changed very much, and in fact, since 1980, have come back up, as you can see. It really was just about the same between 1970 and 1980, and since 1980, poverty has now come back up to 15% of all Americans are under the poverty line. 15% of all people in this country live under the poverty line, and that's about 50% of people who are black. If you start looking at racial categories, then it jumps way up for racial minorities. Just a few other statistics. Again, just in 1984, I did not have the more recent figures, but I think the trend, I do know that the trend has not changed significantly. In 1984, again, 34 million people were in poverty, and that was up 35% since 1979. And then some other figures that I think are just really devastating is that 25% of all children in this country live under the poverty line in 1984, and that is actually still going up. I think it's about 26% now. That's up 51% since 1979. In 5 years, it went up 51% for children under six. These are government figures too. I want to be clear. These are not my own calculations. And at the same time that poverty is going up, benefits are going down. I think that's any secret. Since 1984, the Reagan administration a major part of their policy has been trying to trim down government. Whatever we think about that philosophy, the fact is that benefits have gone down for poor people. So that, for instance, in 1979, the benefits for somebody on AFDC, or Aid to Families with Dependent Children, which is one of the major welfare programs that we have, the amount that a family of four would receive in 1 month was 19% above the poverty line calculation of income. For instance, what it really amounts to, maybe I should put this up so you're going to understand it. In 1979, the poverty line was $3,800. And somebody on AFDC, a family of four, would receive $4,550 a year. Okay, now that's more than the poverty line, that's 19% above. All right, but in 1980,
85, the poverty line is 10,452 for a family of four, but AFDC benefits are only $8,028. So their benefits are 24% below the poverty line. All right. So if a mother has a small child and is not able to work for either physical reasons or because the child is only 1 or 2 years old and she's a single parent, her total benefits would still be under the poverty line. So just to lay that out, because I think that's important to as a background for any of the other stuff that we look at. Now, just a few things. Let me start going through the housing, food, community development aspects of this. In the last 15 years, primarily, in some degree in the last 20 years, there has been a major shift in the urban areas of this country due to white professional people returning to the inner city. In the 1950s and 1960s, we had what was called white flight. People who were living in the cities, a lot of it around civil rights kinds of questions or whatever, left the city and moved to the suburbs. In the last 10 or 15 years especially, that trend has shifted somewhat. And now you have especially young urban professionals, the yuppies, and a lot of other people who have money, want to come back in and live in the city, are moving back into certain kinds of neighborhoods where there is major renovation and development going on. Usually the term used is called gentrification. And that is that's what was happening in my neighborhood in Boston. It was called the South End, not South Boston. Now, you've probably heard of South Boston more than you have the South End. South Boston is where a lot of the racial strife has been. My neighborhood was the most integrated neighborhood in Boston and probably had the least amount of racial problems in some ways. Still, it was there. But it's called gentrification in the sense that you have people who want to come back in, and what is happening, and what was happening in my neighborhood, and this is happening in a lot of places, is you had housing that was really run down. It was very low income housing. And I'm talking about privately owned housing, not just the public housing projects, which is already just in shambles. But privately owned housing. And what is happening is that as this movement takes place, obviously market values go up in a particular area of the city. Condominium developers will go in, buy up housing stock, and then renovate it and sell those back primarily for condominiums. Now, for instance, in Boston, you have a law that requires that anyone developing condominiums and selling it as a condominium has to offer that condominium first to the person presently renting that place previous to the renovation. Okay. Well, let's say that you have a poor family that's living in a very run-down building, but the basic structure of the building is still sound. Okay, well, they'll come in, and all through my neighborhood you see buildings that are gutted. And they'll leave the basic facade of the building, the inner structure of it, and they'll completely renovate it into very, very nice housing. Well, you have a very poor family who are maybe, say 10 years ago, paying $300 a month for a couple-bedroom apartment. That's still, that's cheap in Boston right now. But you might think that's expensive. But let's say they were paying $300 a month. Well, they're going to come in, and maybe the income of the family is $12,000. It's probably less than that. I mean, we figure if somebody's working 40 hours a week, making minimum wage, they make about $8,000 a year. It's not people who are not working who are poor only. It's people who are working 50, 60 hours a week. I mean, can you imagine trying to support two children or more on $8,000 a year. It's absolutely impossible, especially in Boston, which has the highest cost of living in the United States. It's usually in the top one, two, or three of cities in the United States, Boston, New York, and LA. Or San Francisco, I think is the other one. So anyway, the condominium developer comes back in and says, okay, we'll offer you this condominium. It's $180,000 for two bedrooms, 20% down. Now, how in the world somebody making $9,000 a year are going to be able to do that? All right. Well, what happens is that they then are forced out to find another place to live. Well, in my neighborhood, the prices are going up so fast that it was impossible. I mean, I knew people who literally could not find a place to live. There was just no way to find a place in a neighborhood that they had lived for 25 years. That was their home. You always say, well, why don't they go to another neighborhood? Well, this is their home. It's like you're being forced out of your town if you live in a small town. There were people who literally, that has definitely contributed to the homelessness in the city. There are a lot of factors around homelessness, but that was a major part of it. People who simply could not afford to find places to live. Right now in the South End in Boston, you will be lucky to find a studio apartment. I'm not even talking about a full one bedroom for less than $450 to $500 a month. And there are people, again, very poor people who are trying to struggle in that neighborhood. I could tell, and we could talk about this later if people wanted to, there are a lot of things going on in terms of, there are, for instance, a bunch of abandoned buildings that the city has simply let go because what happens is that people who own these buildings do not want to pay the taxes on them. So they lie there, and finally now what the city has done is to start saying, we will essentially take the building back over. You won't have to pay any taxes to us. I mean, the taxes are way up, maybe even more than what the building is worth. So the city has now begun a program of taking over abandoned buildings and selling those buildings very cheaply to nonprofit community development corporations that will then renovate those into low-income housing. So there are some things like that that are going on. There's some, the project that I was involved with is about 100 or 270 unit mixed income housing project where 25% of the residents will be paying full market value in their apartments, 50% will be paying at a slightly subsidized level, and 25% will be low income people who are getting whose rent will be based on 30% of their income. And that is really now becoming about the only way that you can build mixed income housing or any kind of low income housing is to tie low income housing to market rate housing because federal programs for housing have for all practical purposes dried up. There's not hardly any money left to build low income housing. So it's a financial, one of the most creative financial packages I have ever seen is the way that we finance this thing. It involves about 12 different sources of finances. Something like that. I think that I will skip over, and if we want to come back to this, we can talk about some other stuff in detail. But basically, just to sum up the housing, is that basically what it amounts to is that people who have lived in poor neighborhoods for a long time, or maybe all their lives, are now facing skyrocketing market values, for which they've had really no control, and really which they have no benefits from. They don't, for the most part, very few people in those neighborhoods owned those houses. They're not benefiting from the market values going up. They are only being hurt by the skyrocketing rents. So again, housing in the inner city for a poor person, even in very substandard housing, is more expensive than somebody who says rents a much larger and much better apartment in the suburbs very often. I mean, obviously I'm making gross generalizations here, but by and large that's a trend that we're talking about. food cost. One of the things that I often noticed when I would go to families' houses, especially some of the kids that I worked with, I would often be in their homes or in their little apartments or whatever it amounted to. A lot of that was in the public housing project. Let me back up and do say something about public housing projects. In the neighborhood I was in, and this is again very typical, the major public housing project was essentially 50% of it was closed down because it over the years had deteriorated. It had never been kept up, and the maintenance had not been kept up, and now it's to the point where there was not money to pour into really keeping it up. And I guess I also want to dispel the myth that that's all the fault of the people who live there. It's simply the building is 35, 40 years old and very little maintenance has ever been done to it. The elevators don't work anymore. The high-rise parts then are closed down because people can't get up to the 16th floor. Those kinds of things. The lack of housing in Boston is about, I think Boston has the highest housing shortage in the United States. The vacancy rate in Boston, which is the way you usually measure housing shortages, is about 3%. And just one example, when there was a second section of a low-income, mixed-income housing project opened in the neighborhood, there were 7,000 applications on the first morning for 120 spaces. In fact, there was almost a riot because people wanted the applications. There was a picture in the Boston Globe the next day of a guy who was an administrator who got so exasperated that he just took the bundle of papers and threw them out the window at the crowd. So public housing is, and there's a lot of issues that we can talk about that, but just as a general overview. Food, one of the things that I was going to say is I noticed when I would go into people's homes, first of all, because of the size of their apartments and because of their own income, most of them had very small refrigerators. I mean, a lot of times the refrigerators are the size of what we have in college dormitories. I mean, they're maybe about this high. They don't hold very much. And the freezer compartment is about this big. Okay, now these would be, I mean, I can recall one family, the Palmerines, is a Puerto Rican family with five children. They lived in a three-bedroom apartment, and that was the size of the refrigerator they had. The mother was not in very good health. They certainly did not own a car. And there are no supermarkets in, there were not at that time, that has changed now, but there are no supermarkets in the surrounding area that she could go to relatively easily for reasonably priced food. In Roxbury in Boston, which is one of the largest neighborhoods and is essentially all black, there still is not one supermarket in the whole area. And I want to talk about that more when we get to community development, about why that is. But the fact is that she, in order to buy food, ends up most of the time sending out one of her children before each meal to the corner store. Now, first of all, you're not going to get very good, nutritious, fresh food there because I'm talking about a very small little convenience store. Most of it will be frozen foods or canned foods, very limited selection. And the prices, and I went around and did this myself, the prices by and large will be 40% higher than the supermarket a mile away. Well, she has a choice. She can either pay those prices, which is essentially what she does, that family does, or she can say maybe try to get to the supermarket occasionally, but then you're going to talk about having to pay cab fare because there's no transportation, public transportation, I'll get to that in a second, that goes directly between those sections of town. In order to go from this point to this point, she'd have to go into the middle of town and then back out again. And if you've ever been on a subway in Boston, you know it'd be very difficult to carry around a couple bags of groceries on a crowded subway. The final thing is that I drove a cab in Boston, which people think is the most insane thing you could possibly do. And it's probably close for a while I was doing some consulting work and some writing, and it was a way that I could work part-time and make some money. And I became very aware of how, again, poor people are discriminated against in terms of the transportation and as far as food. If she did go to the supermarket in a cab, the chances are that from the point where she would have to get it would cost her at least $5 or $6 each way. And the chances are good that she would have to wait literally an hour or more to get a cab to come to her apartment. Because when you get a radio call in a cab and somebody say the radio call comes in, we need somebody in this particular section of town, most cab drivers aren't going to go into that section if they know that the chances are that the person is going to be poor. They're not going to get a big tip. The same thing happens when you get a call to pick somebody up at a supermarket. If somebody, chances are, not always, but chances are that if you're picking somebody up at a supermarket in Boston, and especially if they tell you where they're going to, you know right off. They're not going to tip you very well. They don't have the money. So they're going to wait for hours, literally hours, in order to get somebody to pick them up. So food becomes very difficult to get. Even if she does go to the supermarket and brings it back, she can't buy more than, say, a day or so's worth of food anyway, because she doesn't have the room in the refrigerator or freezer to put it. Little things that we never probably think about. So she ends up paying 40% more for their food than we would have to pay going to the supermarket. That's what it amounts to. Okay, community development. Again, I've already sort of alluded to some of this. What supermarket chain is going to build a supermarket in the middle of Roxbury? You know, it's simply not seen as good business. And I don't blame the businessmen for that or businesswomen for that in a way, but that's still not fair. Whether or not the decision is a good business decision or not, it's still not fair as far as I'm concerned. There are a couple supermarkets that were burned in Roxbury, but they've never been rebuilt. There are a lot of problems, and essentially it used to be that banks did what was called redlining. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of redlining. But essentially they would literally on a map redline certain areas of the city which they would not make loans to. There would not be any loans made for any projects in that particular part of the city. Now that has now been deemed illegal, was taken to court. The fact is that some of that still happens. It's more subtly perhaps, it's not like an automatic policy of the bank. But it's very difficult to get money invested into community development projects into poor neighborhoods. That is simply the reality of it. And the trend has been that jobs have been moving to the suburbs. In the last 50 years, 80% of new jobs created have been in the suburbs. So again, it's harder for people to find jobs. It's harder. There's no community development. Most of the industry, whatever, is moving out of the city, going to the surrounding areas, which then makes it harder for those people to get there, again, because of transportation. The ghetto or the lower income neighborhoods in cities are becoming more and more isolated than they have been. Now there are some companies that are doing some creative things. Again, in my neighborhood, Digital Equipment Corporation, which is now one of the biggest electronic firms in the country, did build a plant, and they have been very conscious of trying to build plants in areas where there needs to be development and jobs, and I really commend companies with that kind of social consciousness. Unfortunately, there's not enough. Polaroid Corporation is another company that has been doing some very creative work in Boston area around jobs and development. There also, the final sort of option seems to be that the only way that more community development development is going to take place is when churches and nonprofit agencies cooperate together. And there are some examples of those in Boston, and I know of some in Seattle too. I don't know much about the details. Where in Boston it was a matter of City Mission Society, which is an inner city ministry supported primarily by the United Church of Christ, and one particular church in Roxbury joined forces and are now in the process of developing a nonprofit business corporation to develop stores, supermarkets, those kinds of things in the area.
We also have Jubilee Housing in Washington, D.C.
Right.
That answers
okay.
to that.
Yeah, I'm aware. I know some people who worked on that.
Wonderful.
The Church of the Savior.
Yeah. About right. four apartments now.
Right, right. Okay, again, I'm obviously skipping a lot of stuff. Transportation, finally, again, a lot of poor people will not be able to afford a car. And I can tell you, my car insurance, even if I can afford the car, Boston has the highest insurance rates in the United States. And I lived in the highest bracket because it was a high crime area, which is another way in which poor people are hurt, because it's not all poor people who are causing the crime, but they live in the high crime areas. We tend to blame the poor people for living there and having crime. They don't want crime any more than we do, and yet they're the ones that end up having to pay the high insurance rates. I paid in 3 years ago, and it's gone up since then, for a small car. I'm talking about a Nissan car, nothing that was souped up or anything like that that would have high insurance rates on it. I paid $1,050 a year for car insurance, and I have that merit rating. I have the highest merit driving rating in the state. That was with a discount. So most poor people obviously can't afford to even buy a car, much less the insurance. So they're dependent on public transportation. Now, this really varies from city to city. Some cities, I think, really have very good transportation systems. But a lot of this older cities especially, if you look at the transportation system design, and even just to look at a map with the routes on it and visualize it, you can see that the system is designed primarily for bringing people from the suburbs into the city. Everything is more of a spoke of the wheel going into the business areas, the business district, than it is where there are routes that go between sections of the city. So it is very difficult for someone, again, living in Roxbury, to go to the supermarket that I was talking about, because if we looked at the map of Boston is sort of like this, Roxbury is down here, about the nearest biggest supermarkets are up in here. Well, there are bus routes, but in order to do that, you have to change buses a couple times, and it's very difficult. The most direct routes go into the center of town and then back out. And all the rail routes and all that sort of stuff come in from the suburbs. It's really designed to help people who live in the suburbs and who work in the city to get into the city. Most poor people are not going to have any reason to go out to the suburbs for any reason, so it's not going to help them so much. And that's an overstatement, I realize. I mean, there are plenty of routes that go in and out and to different places, and it's obviously not just for that purpose. But the overall structure does tend to be more of an advantage for coming in and out of the city than it does for going to different sections of the city. And I for a long time did not have a car and either rode a bicycle. I usually rode a bicycle, even in the middle of the winter. It was quicker for me to ride a bicycle all the way across town than it was to take a bus, even if I did get frostbite or something. And we've already talked a little bit about the transportation problems with cabs or other options like that. I think I will leave that at that and talk a little bit about
suburban-urban tax structures and the whole sort of relationship there. And I want to say from the outset, I'm not blaming problems on the suburbs. I just want to show some of the dynamics of, again, how people are discriminated against.
Finish this up. Ask you if your same thing was true in Boston, that was true in Chicago on the food, that the chain stores, supermarkets there were some in the poor mm-hmm. area, but the prices were higher,
mm-hmm.
and they claimed yeah. it was to cover their losses.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And instead of distributing that among yeah. all stores, these stores bore that burden so that the poor people had paid.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Where there are stores, they still are higher than they would be in the suburbs. Where people have higher incomes, the prices still are lower. That's what it amounts to. Now, the whole sort of suburban-urban dynamic is something that you hardly ever hear about. And yet, I think it's something that people really need to hear. The first thing I'll just start with is, since we've already talked about housing, is the way in which essentially suburbs have much stricter zoning laws around housing than most areas of the city do. And there are many zoning laws in suburbs, and this is true in Wellesley and Newton and other suburbs of Boston, which are some of the more attractive places to live for people who have middle to upper class incomes. There are restrictions on the size of your lot. It has to be a certain size. It can't be too small. All right. There are restrictions sometimes even on the number of bedrooms in certain areas, certain neighborhoods. There are often in suburban areas are restrictions on apartment complexes. A lot of places you cannot build a multiple apartment complex. It is against the law because of zoning. In Wellesley, there's even a law there, which this isn't directly applicable here, but I just think it's incredible. They have a law that essentially restricts the way it's worded is essentially you cannot have single people living in a house together. You can only have people who are part of a nuclear family living together unless it's your servant. And essentially what they've done is zoned it so that you cannot, there are a lot of cooperative houses where there are people who have their own room and there maybe are, they have divided a large house essentially into separate apartments. And so that people who are not related to each other can share a building as separate apartments. You can't do that in Wellesley. The reason being is primarily one of wanting to maintain a very homogeneous population. And the restrictions on bedrooms and size of lots and on apartment complexes, again, makes it impossible for most poor people to move out of the city. Which was, you say, well, okay, if everything's more important in the city, more expensive in the city, and you can't find housing there and it's less expensive in the suburbs, why not move to the suburbs? Well, there are a lot of reasons for that, obviously. If you were, you would not probably want to move directly into a neighborhood that was completely all of another color, which is what most poor people would have to do. If they moved out of the city, if they're black and moved into an all-white suburb, there would be problems there. But even just financially, it won't work. There's not the availability of inexpensive apartments in a lot of places. Again, that's not always true. And tax structure-wise, what we have is a situation where people in the suburbs use the resources in the city but don't pay taxes to the city. In 1970, and I wish I had an updated figure on this, I know in Boston it's still about the same. The cities
spend about 36% of their budget on education. In suburbs, 56% of the budget is spent. So that's just one example of how public schools in the city really suffer, primarily because the people who have upper incomes usually send their kids to private schools. That's the case in Boston. Something like over 50% of those people with upper incomes in Boston send their kids to private schools. So obviously the voting power there, people are much less concerned about putting money into education. There's more of the poor kids that make up the school population. But at the same time, so all of the suburban workers that work in the city, their taxes are going into their own schools and their own towns. I mean, obviously they should, and there should be their taxes to their own towns. But the fact is, what are some of the things, and we could brainstorm this ourselves, what are the things that suburban people use in the city?
Fire protection,
especially if they have a business there, then they will pay property taxes usually, but they don't pay their own personal income. But fire protection, police protection, even if you're just walking down the street. What's that?
Museums,
absolutely. Library, yeah. I mean, a large percentage of the users of the Boston Public Library, which I think is about the largest in the country, are not residents of Boston. But they don't have to pay any more than a resident does to get the card. Hospitals, the cultural centers, the zoo, a big one in Boston is that the transportation is subsidized. The public transportation is subsidized. Well, you don't come up to buy a ticket and they ask you, are you a resident of Boston? And if you're not, you pay more. You don't. Everybody benefits from that. In Boston, actually, I should say that there is a sharing of that. There is some revenue sharing so that some of the suburbs do pay into that subsidy. So there is a little difference. But they don't pay as higher percentage as the other. You were going to say something?
I was going to ask you about that. Like in Minnesota, so much of that comes back from the state. So
right.
It isn't the city. I mean, it's county or state.
That's right. And so that one becomes a little bit more complicated. You're right. Percentage-wise, it still can be argued in Boston, at least, and I don't know about other places, that that still the people in the city put in a higher proportion of that as far as use.
How about just playing city maintenance?
City maintenance, all those kinds of things. I mean, if they're working there, they come in every day and they spend 8 to 10 hours a day in the city and they benefit from all of those services. And yet, when it comes to funding bills in Massachusetts legislature for special things in the city, there is a very anti-city attitude towards those delegations other than the Boston delegation. And I think that's the general case in the United States, is there's a very anti-urban bias. When New York had to be bailed out financially, and when it was 10, 15 years ago, it's always the city's fault that the city's having a financial problem. And I think New York did make some major financial errors. I don't want to say that. But there's a sense in which we need to look at, and I'm obviously biased, that the city needs to be seen not just simply, we're sort of blaming the victim in a way. Now there are some proposed schemes. I'm trying to finish this up so we can have about 15 minutes of discussion, for trying to make that more equitable. Some things that have been proposed are an employee tax, where you would actually tax people a very small percentage, but still they would pay, if you worked in the city, then you'd have to pay a certain amount of your income into the city where you worked.
Payroll tax,
the same thing, yeah. Payroll tax, employee tax. Another one is a parking tax. Is to essentially find ways of taxing the people who drive into the city or other ways of taxing transportation into the city. So essentially you're taxing those people who come from outside of the city. Now in Boston that has been up for, in 1981 was when that became a really major issue, the parking tax, and the legislature voted, it was a 66-66 tie in the legislature, and they voted it down. They would not allow it. It was a huge controversial issue. The problem is, and in one poll taken in Reading, Massachusetts, of the people who lived there, 70% of the people responding said they felt no fiscal responsibility for Boston, no financial responsibility for the city of Boston. And yet, out of those 128 calls that they made, 128 responses, and out of those 128, 125 of those households had some involvement with Boston in terms of either working there, having had major medical care in the city, or had gone to school there, or used the library. Those are the four things they think. But they still felt no financial responsibility. And I'll just end by saying that one of the problems is in Boston that 51% of the land, the major source of income is property tax, as it is in most cities, not all, but most. 51% of the land in Boston is exempt from property tax, because 23% of it is state. Boston is the capital, see? So 23% of the land in Boston is state-owned property. So the state pays no tax on that, and yet the rest of the state is not, my opinion is not taking its share of the financial responsibility for the city. 11% is colleges, churches, hospitals, universities, museums that are tax exempt. And then 16% are municipal owned property like parks and things like that. So they're having to rely on 49% of the property to generate income to support all the services that the city needs to have. Okay, I felt that's a little rambling, but at least it raises some questions and points out some things that I think we need to at least be concerned about and start trying to address. And I think there's some creative proposals and unfortunately not a lot of support for them sometimes. Let's just, we have about 15 minutes left. We can open this up for questions, comments.
Do they have zone fares in their transportation so the suburban nights pay a little bit more for their trip into town?
Well, there's only two zones. There is a, after you've gone past a certain point, you do pay more, yes, you're right.
Of course, I suppose most of the suburbanites drive their car.
A lot of them do, yeah, a lot. And that one does get pretty complicated. And you do have the Massachusetts Turnpike, in which a lot of them do pay tolls on the turnpike, but I mean, well, that's a, one part of it. But that doesn't go into the city either, the state room. We have two hands over here.
Businesses are paying their fair share of taxes in the cities?
I'm sorry?
Do you think the business community is paying their fair share of taxes in the cities?
I would say probably not, no. Especially with the kind of development. In Boston, again, you've got a situation where there has been incredible business development in the last 10, 15 years. You go to the downtown area of Boston, the financial and business district, and you find, oh, I don't even know how many. I bet there are 10 buildings over 30, 40 stories high that have been built in the last 10 years. There was an attempt, in fact, there was a law passed in Boston that tied business development, new business development and construction to subsidies for low-income housing. Essentially, if somebody was developing a new 50-story building, there had to be worked into that financial arrangement, essentially what amounted to taxes into the city budget that would then be used directly for housing. And that was taken to court and declared unconstitutional. Which I think legally probably was, but the problem was that the businesses fought it, and so that has now been thrown out. I think there are some really good examples of businesses in Boston that are very involved in social the overall concern for the city and are very involved in jobs programs and jobs training and working with universities on that. But by and large, I would say no. Karen?
I wondered how the mixed income housing, I was curious as to how that went over. Was there any problem getting the people with the higher incomes, because there tends to be that snobbishness that if this is, if, you know, low income, then people, it would not be as attractive to the higher income people. Was there a problem with that?
Well, I haven't been there in a year. I was actually the chair of the committee that was dealing with exactly that, was screening applicants mm-hmm. and all that. But I'm obviously off the board now. We had not gotten to the point where we were at the point of soliciting specific applications yet, because it hadn't been finished. We weren't even close to being finished. But our hunches and projections are that is such a desirable place to live, that people, and that the market rates in there will probably be slightly cheaper than places of comparable quality somewhere else, that people will jump at the chance to live there.
Is that kind of like the hunger of some of those building projects were designed for that multiple living? My mother lives in an apartment complex that is mm-hmm. depends on income and investments, all that kind of stuff. That's
right. There are plenty of projects around and programs around that still are on that basis. It's very
problem in terms of people in.
The problem has been that for any new housing, it's been almost impossible. And this was a completely privately done thing, with support of the city, eventually, finally, and major loans from the Massachusetts Housing Finance Agency. And those all become public and very political kinds of decisions. It's fascinating working on this stuff. But it's very hard to find significant amounts of money where you can essentially work with one program, a federal or state program, and develop significant housing. It's just really very hard.
We've been getting quite a few low-income housing projects in the Ballard area, and quite close to the shopping. Mm-hmm. Very nice.
Mm. Well, that's good. That's good if they're not being restricted there. And I think there more of that is happening, but for a long time, and still in a lot of places, it's really zone restricted. Yes?
What do you see the long-term results of the, say, the young, urban couples moving back into the inner city?
Well, I think several things. I think... I think, first of all, that it is almost defining, even in more strong terms, racial lines by neighborhood. I mean, that's always been a problem in Boston and a lot of places. And one of the problems in Boston racially is that there is such a division between neighborhoods and by color. And now you have the situations where most of, or at least a lot of the neighborhoods where the young professionals are moving back into have been neighborhoods where there have been significant numbers of people of color living. And more of those people are now being pushed out, so it's now becoming again more of a all-white neighborhood. Now, in the interim, it looks like we have great integration. But I don't think that's going to be the long term. I think in the long term, it's going to have just the opposite effect. And so that you are, again, having a lot of segregated kinds of housing, which is, I think that's a negative trend in a big way. Financial? Oh, go ahead.
Another question. Do you ever see the change in sort of governmental boundaries and then? So instead of a city system, you might expand to a metro or a county government?
Well, that has certainly been proposed by a lot of people. I don't I can't say that I'm an expert on those proposals. There are certainly, in almost every major city now, you already have metropolitan commissions that do govern certain aspects of the services together. For instance, one would be in a lot of areas of transportation system. In Boston, there's the Metropolitan Commission, which deals with certain major roadways parks, for instance, that sort of cross certain boundaries. And you actually have a separate police force that is a metropolitan police force. And they then are the ones that you can always tell if the policeman at the corner is metropolitan police, then this road is governed by the Metropolitan Commission. And it gets really complicated in who's what, you know. And then I know of examples where somebody's run to find a police officer and they found the Metropolitan Police and they said, well, no, I can't do that because that's not my jurisdiction, you know. I think that there would be, you know, real advantages in that. And there have been attempts. I'm trying to remember, what city was it a couple years ago that tried to annex a major area? And I can't remember all the details about who wanted it what. I think that's something to really consider. It's a good question. Real good question. Paul?
The last two red figures down there indicated a rather permanent problem that we have in this country, and that is that that lower income group of people, lowest income group of people who really have to live on government benefits of one kind or another, that any rising prosperity on the part of the general population has not really affected that segment of
that's
our population.
Right. Exactly right.
That quote trickle down theory that is currently approved by our government,
yeah,
or at least this seems to be the philosophy, does not seem to affect that large segment of people that are almost permanently dependent on the government. And some other way has got to be found than just to say that the general prosperity of the country will raise everyone.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't happen that way.
Yeah, and there's a lot of talk now about what we're calling about sort of the permanent underclass.
Yeah.
And the ways in which we see there's a economic shift in our country, I mean, this is nothing new, between sort of the industrial manufacturing to the service-oriented industries. The problem is that service-oriented, whether that's financial or other kinds of servicing, does not provide jobs for people that we're talking about that are not educated. The jobs that, the kinds of jobs that you do have, maybe the entry-level jobs that you do have for some of those new services, are McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to pay minimum wage, and where there's very little availability of advancement or a major kind of advancement.
Or benefits.
Or benefits,
no,
right?
No benefits.
Yeah, and those jobs are perfect. Are consciously kept to be part-time jobs. I mean, if you can get 20 people to work your shifts part-time, you don't have to pay them benefits. And
not only that, did you know in McDonald's that they have to sell so much? I was talking to Bill Works there. And if they don't sell so much in a period of time, somebody has to go home.
That's right, you're not even guaranteed your hours.
That kind of
that's
a
right.
pay scale. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what happens is that we are losing a lot of the jobs that used to be jobs that someone could support a family on and that really were fairly stable jobs, and the ones we're gaining will not support. I mean, again, we're talking about $3.35 an hour. If you work 40 hours, even 50 hours a week at that, you're still talking about less than $10,000 a year. and there's just very little, and I don't have the answer to that. Jody Kretzman, who is from Chicago and is really quite involved with the Mayor of Washington administration, in fact is the chair of his policy committee, was here earlier in the summer, and he did some sessions on that, and he and I had some long conversations mm-hmm. about that. He says, I don't know where the hope is. He says that economically, I don't know how we're going to get ourselves out of this. He had some...
There is a movement, I think, underway in Congress that to up the minimum wage to $4.60 an hour.
Right.
And to have all employers give basic health insurance, right. Most minimum. Right. And I think Kennedy is very much behind this.
Yeah, I mean, Kennedy's always been behind health insurance and the national health insurance and all that. Yeah. I think the minimum wage has a better chance of passing, though, than the health insurance. We've never had a real... We've always, in our congressional history, have voted down almost every effort to get major reforms in health insurance. Let me get all of this from that.
Yes. With the high percentage of children... in living in poverty, I think the daycare centers are a major item that have to be considered subsidized, whatever, and the quality has to be good.
There is in Massachusetts, Governor Dukakis, and I'm sorry for talking out of only about Massachusetts, which is 3,000 miles away, but that's simply what I know about. There has been a program proposed which has now gotten a lot of attention, and now Washington State is doing something similar called Workfare. And it's been rather controversial, and it's been interesting because there have been people both in the sort of traditionally conservative camps and rather progressive camps that have, in both camps, there have been people who have strongly opposed and strongly supported the kind of programs. But part of that program in Massachusetts, which involves job training and sort of a gradual trying to shift people from welfare to jobs, and I think there's some real good possibilities in it because it is not simplistic. It really is taking into account job training, and it has a fairly major part of the budget is child care, and recognizing that. I don't think it's by any means perfect, but it may actually... Some good, I don't know. Paul, do you want
to
say something?
Yeah, I was going to. That's part of what I was going to comment on was that I think this rather permanent underclass, as you call it, that just the provision of jobs is not going to solve the problem this group of people has been in existence long enough now so that most of them are not equipped to really deal with the kind of jobs that are available nowadays, which require a certain amount of education, a certain amount of sophistication, and so on. So that they're going to, if you're going to deal with that class of people, and I hate to use the word class, but it's there.
Right.
If you're going to deal with that group of people, we've got to have some other kind of innovative things, like this workfare thing, and which is only a drop in the bucket, but educational-wise and training-wise and acculturation-wise and so on.
We're also talking about, and I just realized we're slightly past time, I didn't realize that, we're also talking about not just financial dimensions, we're talking about emotional and psychiatric dimensions of a whole problem where people simply don't have any hope anymore of going anywhere.